Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, everyone. Welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey and Chad here, your host for this weekend show, as well as your host on our website, kereport.com, and podcast, The KE Report. Please, everyone, be sure to go back through our website and podcast, listen to the daily editorials and company updates that we recorded, more touching base on markets and any big picture themes that our guests noted on this weekend show. We are going to, again, stick a lot big picture for especially recapping some of the key meetings that happened this week, as we are going to kick off the show here with Mark Chandler. And then in the back half of the show, going to get, I think, a little bit more focused on some of the markets, but it's all about, at least for a lot of our investors, what's going on in the resource sector. So that's going to come in the second half of the show. As I mentioned, we are chatting with Mark Chandler, managing partner at Bannockburn Global Forex, also editor of the Mark to Market website. Now, Mark, a number of different big meetings that happened this week. We had Jackson Hole with Jerome Powell speaking at the end of the week. But earlier in the week, we had the BRICS meeting. And what came out of that BRICS meeting was adding new members. I know some people were looking for some news on a potential gold-backed currency, but really, the meeting seemed to be all about if or if not to add new members. And at the end of the week, they did add some new members. So, Mark, recap that BRICS meeting and what stood out to you, please.
Yeah, sure. So it's interesting, of course. You know, this is like something like the 7th or 8th BRICS summit. This one had attracted a lot of attention, partly, I think, because of sort of this echo chamber in the social media about an alternative currency, an alternative token to settle trade. As you mentioned, Corey, I think the outcome is really that it's going to grow, and it's going to grow significantly in terms of 6 countries accepted to were invited to join, and a few more next year. And so when you think about like what a group it represents, it's getting close to like say 40 or 45% of GDP, 30% of world trade. So it does have some heft, but I think that sort of begs the question is, what is it? Is it a bloc? Is it an alliance? What is it? And I don't think it's clear yet. And so I don't really see this as a market factor. I think it drew a lot of attention, but I don't really see it as a market factor. If they were able to act in unison around some issue, that would be a different story. But I see a lot of like conflicting rivalries, and I see unclear about what they're really doing. I mean, there was I think there was some objection to whether they should have more members. And this is also the problem that the Eurozone, and well, I should say the EU had. Do you broaden it out or do you deepen it? Do you broaden it, let more members in, or do you deepen it and improve the cooperation, coordination within that area? And I think that the BRICS have really decided to broaden rather than to deepen. And I think the broader it gets, I think it dilutes any kind of radical threat that it might have posed. I think of it very much like the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, which is really the second initiative by China after the Belt Road Initiative. And the AIIB, as it's called, initially the U.S. didn't like it, didn't want our allies to join it. The U.K. joined it, and now several NATO members are part of it. And yet, it's not very radical. It takes subscriptions in U.S. dollars. Most of the loans are in U.S. dollars. And so I think that the BRICS is going to be like this, more of a talking shop than some kind of new model UN or something like that.
Yeah, Mark, I think that's a pretty solid takeaway, because so far they haven't really expressed what they're actually doing as a group. Yes, they've let in Iran and Saudi Arabia and Egypt, and they plan to let in the UAE and Argentina and Ethiopia and some other countries, but they haven't actually expressed what they're actually doing yet. Even though they have some trading initiatives, it's still kind of a muddy question. So to your point, it really didn't move the markets. It was interesting. It made a lot of press, but what does seem to be moving the markets more is the market's infatuation with what central banks are doing. And so we should bring up that with Powell on the mic at Jackson Hole today, and then other central banks also there, the ECB there, the Bank of England there, the Bank of Japan. It is There's a lot of news coming out of that, but it doesn't seem like much has changed there. What's your key takeaway from the Jackson Hole Summit so far?
So far, I'd say we haven't really learned anything new. I think there was such a big buildup for Powell's speech today, and I think it lasted about 16 minutes or so. And at the end of the day, I don't really see him breaking any new ground. I sort of heard it to be a broad summary of policy and economic trends since his last speech at Jackson Hole. He didn't really give us more insight into what the Fed's going to do. The market has slowly crept up this week. The odds of a Fed hike in September, they meet September 20th, but the odds are still low at about 20% or so. They were about 10% a week ago. I think that the focus really ought to be on the November meeting rather than September meeting. And there we've seen the odds creep up a little bit better now than 50%, actually getting closer to 60% now on the chance of a November hike. You know, because the Fed hiked in July, no meeting in August, the September is really it would be back-to-back meetings. And there's nothing that suggests to me from Fed officials that there's so urgent pressure now that they acknowledge that we're in restrictive territory to have to raise rates at back-to-back meetings. So I'd still say November, and that lets the compromise then with some of the doves who've been talking about an extended pause. But my sense, though, is that the real challenge is that can the market have it both ways? You know, this week, the Atlanta Fed revised up its GDP tracker to 5.9%. Even if they're 50% wrong, I mean, they don't have really that much data for August yet. And so they're still early on in the data collection cycle. And so even if they're off by half, we're still looking at an acceleration from Q2. And I think that that's what I'm really watching for next week. That'll help shape expectations for Fed policy. Two big data points. One is the personal consumption expenditures. And this is the retail sales measures, a little bit more than a third of what U.S. consumers buy, partly because it doesn't really pick up that many services. The personal consumption expenditure is a much broader measure. And the median forecast in Bloomberg surveys for a 0.7% increase. It would be the largest since January and would suggest that demand, which Powell spoke to, remains strong. However, at the end of the week, September 1st, the U.S. is going to report the jobs data. And there it seems quite clear that the employment market is slowing. The issue I think that Powell raised is it's slowing fast enough to reduce demand and reduce price pressures. And I think that the risk to me is that we might see a later in September, the second consecutive monthly increase in headline U.S. CPI.
It seems like everybody listening to Powell, and we all know how much the Fed can move markets, especially when they do pivot or if they pivot. Everyone's trying to get some long-term forecast from Powell and from the Fed, but he's consistently told us that they are going to see how this trickles through to the consumer, to the markets. Yes, the Fed is market dependent, but look, the Fed has just gone through a very aggressive tightening cycle, and the economy hasn't collapsed on itself. It might be coming, but as of right now, the Fed has given themselves some cover, or at least I think they have, to sit on the sidelines. And since they have hiked rates so much, well, you can argue that they do have some bullets in the chamber, some tools at their disposal if we do get a big market pullback. Mark, how do you try to filter through all this talk from Powell and all the markets saying, oh, we're predicting this much of a rate hike or this much of a rate cut a year out? It does impact markets. But again, the Fed's just going to be sitting on the sidelines here for, it sounds like, as long as they can.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what you say makes sense to me. I think that's why the September dot plots, the summary of economic projections, is going to be so important. I can see how the Federal Reserve will have to revise up growth again, probably revise down unemployment. But remember that when you look at those Fed's, the dots for policy for Fed funds next year, remember in June, the Fed assumed they hiked rates twice. So far, they've only hiked rates once here in the second half. But the median dot looks for four cuts next year from after the two that they anticipated in the second half of this year. So I think the Fed has encouraged the markets to think that the sequence of events would be something like this. high nominal interest rates, and we're making new highs this week on, say, the US 2-year and the 10-year. And as inflation falls, that means the real rate is higher. And the higher real rate, that's what really is a measure of like the restraint on the economy, is where the inflation adjusted rate is. So in effect, what's happening is that the Fed is raising rates at the short end, as you know, and what's happening then is that the inflation is falling, and that's raising the real rate at the long end, which acts as a brake on the economy. And so I think that the Federal Reserve thinks then that as real rates rise, they'll be able to cut rates just to keep the real rates sort of at status quo levels. So I do think the Fed's going to be cutting next year. I think the issue is when. And right now, I'd say the first, what's happened, in, I'd say, in recent days is that the market's pushed back, fully discounting the first rate cut into Q3 next year from Q2.
Yeah, Mark, we've seen that pattern all year long of the rate cuts being pushed back because it was going to be the very beginning of this year, then the middle of this year, then the end of this year, then the first quarter, second quarter. Now it's all the way back to the third quarter of next year as far as when these rate cuts will come. But you brought up those an interesting point with the real rates, the inflation adjusted rates. As inflation comes down and interest rates move up, real rates are going higher. With the 2-year at 5.05 at the time of this recording and the 10-year up to 4.24, what does that mean for the rest of the markets? What's your takeaway from what the bond market is signaling?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, just because there seems to be so many different issues, and people are like operating at different like time scales, in the sense that we begin looking past the next rate, the next couple of months where rates still might go higher, and should we be beginning to anticipate for corporate America lower interest rates? And so I think the market's pulled there, and you saw this week the pull from some of the tech stocks, chips, and the AI theme seem to have been further expressed this week. So it's hard for me to really translate this macro view into the stocks. I still see them struggling a bit. Interest rates are still making new highs, and so but I see other effects of this. I mean, I'm looking at the gold, for example, and typically when interest rates rise and the dollar is strong, that typically is the precedent for gold. And gold has fallen for the past 4 weeks, but this week it's snapping that. For the first time in 5 weeks, we'll get a higher close in gold and the spot market above 1900 again.
Mark, can you carry that over also to the markets, though? Because the markets were on a bit of a losing streak, but they might be snapping out of that this week, too. It seems like this week's almost like a reversal week, except for the fact that the dollar continued to rise and rates are still very high.
Yeah, I was looking at the S&P, and yesterday, we made an outside down day, and that's technically bearish. I mean, we take out the previous day's high, and then take out the previous day's low, settle below the previous day's low, and that's what the S&Ps did. But the follow through was pretty limited, and we held above last week's lows. So in my broad, like, if I could write the script for next week, it'd be something like this. S&Ps might struggle in the first part of the week, but then rally on the back of the weak jobs number that I expect next Friday.
Well, Mark, let's also talk about that strong dollar because that has been making some news and it's up above 104 now. It's usually, as you say, a pressure on gold, but a pressure on many markets. It does seem like some of this strength in the dollar is also just because there are some other fluctuations in other global currencies that it's weighted against. How do you look at the currency markets overall right now?
So this has been an important week from a, like I say, from a price action point of view. The euro fell through 108 for the first time, I want to say since middle of June, and that's below the 200-day moving average, which comes in there as well, about 108.05. This will be the first time since the end of last year, I want to say in November last year, that the euro has traded below its 200-day moving average. So I think that once again, we're in this position of divergence where the US economy looks fairly strong, while the Eurozone, and in fact, not only the Eurozone struggling, but today the Bundesbank, the German central bank, said that Germany, the biggest economy in the Eurozone, may stagnate for another quarter here. So we did see this breakdown. We got to wait for the close, though, because we can have this intraday penetration. And we fell down to about 107.65, but still, it sort of returned to that 108 area. Sterling had a similar thing happen. We've been for the most part holding above 126. Could be some intraday closes below it. Today we fell to a little bit below 125.50. So that's a serious break, a half a cent move. We're holding below that 126 now. But if it's true, if that move is sustained, 124 is the next target, and there's potential that you can go down to about 120. I'm looking at, for those of you who follow the charts, I'm looking at a potential head and shoulders top in sterling. With that neckline at 126, it's about a 6 to 7 cent pattern. So take a look at that. We don't really often see such nice head and shoulder patterns in the FX market, but there looks like one in sterling. So I'm concerned too. The Canadian dollar moves above 136, but I should say the U.S. dollar moves above Canada 136, and it brings into the frame the April and May highs around 136, call it 50 to 60 area or 60 to 70 area, and so we're brushing along that as well. I'm not yet sure that we're going to have this as a big breakout. A lot of the momentum indicators are stretched for the dollar, but it's hard to fight it when you have rising interest rates.
Mark, what's actually driving these currency moves? Is it actual economic data, or is it simply, again, central bank expectations?
Yeah, so I would not put those two as like mutually exclusive. I think that the central bank expectations, like with the Fed, is being driven by expectations of the economy. And so I think that the market is really taking rates up faster than the Fed is. You think about what's happened in recent weeks. And also what concerns me too along these lines is market positioning. I was looking at the futures positioning in both the 2 year and 10 year, and we're near historic extremes for both of them. So the market, so th to me, this is a continuation of the trend move. And what I'm waiting for is some clear sign of capitulation. And looking at today's price action, looking at this week's price action, I don't think it's a capitulation trade yet.
Mark, speaking of capitulation, a lot of people were expecting, and we've talked about this with you a number of times on a lot of our guests, we're expecting a recession to already have arrived this year. Thus far, it seems like the market has been far more resilient. The economy has been far more resilient. The consumer has been far more resilient. There are some cracks under the surface, but how does this worry about a contraction coming affect the markets? And is this just a bear market rally within a larger bear market, or are we seeing the markets actually have a sea change and just dust off the fears of a recession altogether?
Well, it's true, Chad, that many economists, many of the big banks, have revised their forecasts and no longer look for a recession. And to me, that's not a good sign. That is a type of capitulation. The people have been, like you say, talking about a recession since early last year. We had those first 2 quarters of last year contraction, but since then, growth has been generally strong. And not only has it been strong, but as Powell mentioned, it's been growing above their long-term rate. What the Fed sees is the long-term rate, which is really should be understood as like the speed limit, the non-inflationary speed limit for the economy. So yeah, Chad, I think that this is exactly the problem, that the market might have given up just as the economy slows down. And we'll see that more, I think, in the coming months, with especially in the jobs market. That becomes the key, because when you think about what fuels demand, but we'd call it the wealth effect for 2/3 of the economy or 70% of the economy, the wealth effect, which is income and appreciation of our financial assets. And income is jobs. And as the job market slows down, and remember what's going to happen too next month, is the student loans in the US begin accumulating interest again, first payments due in October. And so this might be the last hurrah of the US consumer before they pull back a little bit into the end of the year.
Mark, elaborate on that a little bit, because we have heard the fact that student loans are, again, going to start accumulating interest. People are going to have to start paying those back. How big of an impact could that have on markets, more specifically, outside of just the economy?
I don't think it would naturally would have much impact, except sort of within the context. And the context is the consumers have been on a bit of a splurge lately, and household the savings, the excess savings that were accumulated during COVID have been mostly worn down now, and mostly spent down through like actual expenditures and through inflation eating away the value. And so I think it just comes. The resumption of student loans and student loan servicing, I think that the average might be $350 to $400 a month, something along those magnitude for repayment. I think that's going to curb demand. on the margins, but makes it all the more important because of the what I would expect to be that slowdown coming from the jobs market in any event. You know, I should say too, the as we look ahead for thinking about what's going to happen in the coming weeks, remember that this summer we had a debt ceiling issue, and the debt ceiling, if the U.S. didn't come up with a resolution to that, it would have led to default, as we know. But what's happening now is this is the end of the next month is the end of the fiscal year for the U.S. I should say they have to get together to have the new fiscal year's budget in place by the 1st of October. And that requires an appropriations bill. That's a spending bill. And Congress, it could be another game of brinkmanship. We could go all the way to the end of the month. And what's hanging over us now is not so much a default, but a shutdown, at least a partial shutdown of the government. So that's all looming ahead of us. And I think we have to, and so for me, the sequence of events, we get past the employment numbers slowing down, CPI likely to tick up. And then the second half of the month, we'll worry about a government shutdown.
Well, Mark, looking into the economic data that's on tap, as you just outlined there, is there anything that you think could really change the narrative? I mean, a lot of people are obsessed still with what's happening with inflation, what's happening with the jobs number, the retail strength, the strength of the consumer, manufacturing, real estate. Is there any area of this economic data that you think could really change things up in the narrative?
Well, here's what concerns me, is that back in March, we were all concerned about the bank stress emerged. And part of the reason was that some banks were having difficulty coping with the higher interest rate environment. What's happened since then, of course, is that interest rates are higher. And so what I'm concerned about is that there could be still some blowback from banks, and maybe that takes place through the commercial real estate sector, which they're exposed to. But I'd say what when you ask Shad what could change the narrative, that's what concerns me, is that maybe it's not the economic data per se, maybe it's coming out of the banking sector in midst of these higher interest rates. And just to point that out, the KRX, which is the index of regional banks, down for a third consecutive week. We're off about 2.8% after falling 6% last week. So U.S. bank stocks are struggling, and I kind of worry that it's looming on the horizon as a potential risk to our, sort of keep chugging along type of scenario.
All right. Well, Mark, thank you very much for kind of sharing your insights then on what we saw this week from a lot of key meetings and what Jerome Powell had to say. We're all just kind of in that wait and see period here, but the rollover in markets has definitely caught some people's attention. And we even had some commentators earlier in the week mention how the earnings season, how reactions to these earning beats have been very different compared to the last quarter, last couple quarters. Maybe we're seeing a shift in these markets. And hey, markets moving down can also force the Fed's hand too. So boy, oh boy, it seems never ending that we are talking about this, but well, we are. So you know what? I'm sure we will continue to. Mark, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts on this weekend's show. We'll chat with you next Friday. And everyone, stick around. We are going to be right back with a bit more of a focus in the resource and commodity sector.
Thanks. Good luck to everybody.
Al Corlin's firm, AB Corlin and Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.